Simon ran out of the woods, and the hunters killed him. The next night, Jack, Roger, and Maurice stole Piggy's glasses. Ralph, Piggy, and Sam and Eric went to retrieve his glasses. This action resulted in Piggy's death. Ralph was now alone, running from Jack and the savages. Jack set the whole island on fire, which flushed Ralph out. Fortunately, a military group saw the fire and were waiting at the beach. Ralph fell at the officer's feet and told him the story. Conflict, man versus man, and man versus himself, because the boys fought each other and the savages within themselves. Voice, the story was written in the third-person point of view because the author, William Golding, is narrating the story. Tone, the tone of this story is the adventure, nothing happy or sad about it, with the exception of two deaths. For the most part, Mount Carmel's English teachers let students choose their own books from a predetermined list rather than assigning specific titles to all students. Rob opted for the classics, relatively dense books, with big themes, often rooted in mortality. Jack London's The Call of the Wild, conflict, man versus man, and man versus himself, because Buck had to prove to his owners as well as himself that he was a leader. John Steinbeck's The Pearl, conflict, man versus man, and man versus himself, because Kino fought many people and the emotions of shooting his son. Mark Twain's The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, conflict, man versus man, and man versus himself, because Tom fought many people in the story and his own bad judgment. He always made a cover for his book reports with crayon illustrations and large, elaborate lettering. The above excerpt, written on Lord of the Flies in sixth grade, received an A along with a note scrawled diagonally by the teacher. I would like you to share this with the class. He wrote succinct sentences, each leading quietly into the next, short on adverbs and adjectives, penned in cursive, perfected under Skeet's watch. His teachers were accustomed to grading book reports composed of a few poorly punctuated and often illegible sentences, and Rob quickly found himself singled out, often prodded to read his work aloud to the class. His ability to consume and digest pages was iconoclastic at Mount Carmel. As his teachers gradually learned through parent-teacher meetings with Jackie, he read these books and wrote these reports with minimal help from her, as on the nights she wasn't working, he tried to finish his homework before she came home from the day shift so that the two could hang out. His real passions were math and science, subjects in which hard conclusions were calculated from known variables by way of clear, logical processes that were largely absent from his life. The key component of middle school math was showing the work, mapping the pathway between questions and answers. His teachers graded the format and logic of the problem-solving with the same weight as the solution itself. At first, Rob took issue with this and would repeatedly write only the answer. His fifth-grade math teacher was fairly convinced he was cheating on his homework by using a calculator, that he wasn't learning how to problem-solve. In fact, Rob wouldn't own a calculator until freshman year of college. She sent home a note to Jackie. I'm not cheating, Rob told his mother adamantly. I know, she replied. Just do what she says and show your work. It's just a waste, he replied, as if the world were conspiring to get one over on him. A waste of what? Paper, pencil, lead, my time. Talking to Rob like talking to his father could be beyond frustrating when he had a firm opinion on a matter. Just do it how they want it, Jackie said. And then something occurred to her. How do you get the right answers without writing anything down anyway? I do it in my head, he replied. Jackie won, and Rob began to painstakingly write out every step of his problem sets, often making little notes in the left margins, explaining what he did, as if the teacher grading might not be up to speed. As the math advanced from fifth grade to eighth grade, from long division to algebra and geometry, so did these sheets of calculations, often with extra loosely paper stapled to the back. As in English, his work was often displayed on a bulletin board. Rob was not as proud of these accolades as his teachers thought he should be. He rarely cracked a smile. They were mystified by his nonchalance that bordered on apathy. Most kids his age, especially those from suboptimal circumstances, received a significant confidence boost from public praise. In contrast, Rob would turn away from his work on display, as if it were all he could do not to tear it down. Rob had always been what most would describe as a nerd. with the loss of his father's persistent street influence, the nerd was permitted to flourish unbridled, beginning at age 7. Like his father's, Rob's brain had a huge capacity to store facts. Unlike his father, however, Rob developed an outsized work ethic and attention span. He was able to open a book and read straight through until he finished it, or study the science texts until all the relevant facts were embedded. His mother encouraged this. His teachers marveled at it. The other boys in his orbit, at least those who were not his close friends, were less impressed, which engendered the fundamental struggle of Rob's adolescence. Being a fatherless boy in East Orange was hard, but being a nerd was harder. The struggles of losing a father, emotional, social, financial, were helped by the fact that they were shared with so many of his peers and thus provided a common bond through individual hardship. Without necessarily trying to, Rob would draw these particular boys to him. Though they communicated in typical kid speak over typical topics, football, girls, complaining about school, a genuine, mature tenderness manifested in their interactions that touched Jackie deeply. Most of Rob's friends were good boys in their hearts. They called her Ms. Peace, had fine manners, and didn't talk back. And they were always around, either on the street or on the porch or in the house. Her son, though now fatherless, and in some ways motherless, considering her hours, was hardly ever alone. She'd always wanted her son to have a sibling, and now on weekends she felt as though he had more than one. These relationships, the way the boys talked often of brighter futures, drew forth faint music from Jackie's heart, allowed her to feel that she was doing well in the parental intricacies she could control and doing her best in those she couldn't. But being academically gifted presented a different struggle entirely, because, unlike fatherlessness, Rob is isolated in it. His schoolwork, the unbroken succession of A's year after year, the solitary hours spent obtaining them, was an aspect of his life that could not be shared. He had his close friends, to whom grades did not matter at all, but the rest of the kids at Mount Carmel did not know what to make of this young, hard-looking upstart whom most of the nuns adored. So many of them treated him with suspicion, and their suspicion bred scorn. Private school could be even worse in this regard than Oakdale, because Mount Carmel presented a more competitive environment. The academic structure could also breed more negativity. Periodically, Jackie would come home at the end of the day to find her son sitting alone in the dark, sulking, and she knew something had happened that day. Some cruel name had been applied to him. These were some of the rare moments when he still permitted her to embrace him physically, and a part of her was grateful for the ridicule her son endured so quietly. And then there were the various arenas he had to navigate outside school, on the street. Walking from Mount Carmel to Chapman Avenue, Rob would pass the Centerview Plaza apartment project on Center Street, which had neither a view nor a plaza, but always a steady stream of hustlers walking in and out. Followed by 4 blocks of houses inhabited by people who'd known his father, and then town liquor and the teenagers hanging outside. Sometimes he might cut across Pearson Street to pass the burnt shell of his father's old house, but whichever route he took, loud music played, drug deals were transacted, threats were dealt. Some people would tell him how sorely his father was missed, while others would step in front of him and aggressively try to create conflict. Something Rob learned to avoid by naming someone he knew in the projects, constructing a human bridge over the social gaps between them. This happened almost every day while Rob, wearing the pink shirt and purple tie, made his way home along with whoever was walking with him that day. Starting in 7th grade, he was usually walking with Victor Raymond. Victor had grown up in Bridgeton, a working-class, ethnically split town in southern New Jersey. When he was 11, his parents both passed away from illness within months of each other, and he lived with his 17-year-old brother, the aptly monikered Big Steve, who gave up a college football scholarship in order to work, pay the mortgage, and raise Victor. Then the state involved itself and declared that Steve, himself still a minor, could not be considered a legal guardian. So Victor moved north to live with his aunt in her apartment on Center Street adjacent to Orange Park, about a quarter mile from the Peace home. She sent him to Mount Carmel, where Victor was taken with the quiet boy who sat in the back, somehow found a way to make the school uniform look thuggish, and scored 100% on every test. Rob took Victor under his wing, invited him to play in his football games, helped him study, and provided an unvoiced assurance that, though Victor was reeling from the loss of his parents and the vastly different climate in Orange, everything would be okay. The first time Rob called Victor's apartment to hang out, his aunt answered the phone, heard the deep, drawn-out voice on the other end, and asked Victor, "What is a grown man doing calling and asking for you?" Victor told her that this was the kid he'd been talking about, the one with the best grades. Rob and Victor were 11, then 12, then 13 years old, and feeling their minds expand exponentially each year. At the same time, they commuted daily through a slum populated by people they knew and liked, but who never seemed to change at all. In order to make these transits safely, they had to be seen as fully a part of the streets and their residents. If they happened to be carrying any money, they would spread the bills around their bodies, tucked inside socks, back pockets, and underwear, leaving a few dollars in their wallets, so that in the event they were mugged, which they were 3 times during middle school, they could hand over their wallets and plead their case. "This is all I have. Take it." They carried their book bags everywhere, slung over their shoulders, so that they seemed to be going to or from school and thus not threatening anyone's turf. Too, for Rob, this meant talking like the people talked, quoting the lyrics they quoted, playing football the way they played, and never letting them forget that he was Skeet Douglas's son. Not relevant in this arena were the Catholic principles of patience, pacifism, and conflict resolution taught at Mount Carmel. Nor was Rob's widening knowledge of American literature, human biology, European history, and algebra. Victor watched Rob begin to develop and hone the system of neural switches, the subtle, never-ending calibrations of behavior and speech that enabled him at intervals throughout the day to be an ideal student, the stand-in provider on Chapman Street, and just another mouthy kid parlaying on the corner of Hickory Street and Central Avenue. Further subsets existed within each of these roles, a complex network of personalities, each independent of the others, that Rob had to assume. In school, he listened attentively to the nuns and their Christ-centric lessons. He was a steady sounding board for the personal lives of Victor and the rest of his friends. Though he was not a leader by nature, he became one by the example he set, and he assumed this role dutifully. He spoke slowly, enunciated clearly, and the faculty often deployed him to resolve conflicts among the students. At home, he was obedient to his rapidly aging grandparents, mindful of the chores Horace still assigned a generation after his own children had performed them. He was enthusiastic about rendering his day to Jackie when she had the energy to listen, and quiet when she did not. To the extent that he was allowed, he participated decisively in matters of time, property, and especially money. And on the streets outside, he knew everyone by name. He never lowered his head to scuttle past the hustlers, as most of his classmates did, but engaged with them as people. During football games, he continued flipping ball carriers over his shoulder and not helping them up. He walked with his head raised and his chest puffed out, spoke fast and commandingly, and he took to being called by his middle name, Deshaun, and later just Sean, in much the same way that his father had opted for Skeet over their shared given name. Each day, he was all of these people. But at any given moment, he walled off all but one. This existence was fracturing, but it was the only way to integrate his ambition and intellect in a milieu in which neither had currency and in which both could get him hurt. He had a title for this all-encompassing process. He called it Newark-proofing himself. Rob and Jackie kept visiting Skeet after he was transferred to Trenton State Prison in January 1991. Jackie would borrow her parents' car and endure an hour of monotony on the New Jersey Turnpike before taking the I-295 spur west into Trenton. The prison rose ominously from the surrounding neighborhood of short, narrow row houses and wholesalers. Whereas Essex County Jail was surrounded by chain-link fencing, Trenton State was wrapped by an unbroken brick-and-concrete wall that exuded permanence, like a coffin the size of a city block. This wall was 20 feet tall but rose to 7 stories in some stretches, a fortress on the scale of the medieval structures Rob had been reading about in history books. Manned turrets resembling airport towers were spaced at 50-yard intervals, dwarfing the steeple of the Church of God of Prophecy across the intersection at Cass and 2nd Streets. On the Cass Street end of the prison, which was the stretch Rob and Jackie drove along to reach the visitor parking lot, a colorful panoramic mural depicting a baseball game ran along the wall for its entirety of 200 yards. Directly on the other side of this wall, attached to it, lived New Jersey's death row inmates. If walking into Essex County the first time had felt to Jackie and Rob like a passage into purgatory, then the entryway to Trenton State was hell. 100 Essex County jails could fit into Trenton State. Through barred windows and the visitor hallways inside, they could glimpse the first inmate buildings across a concrete courtyard, 6 stories high and 100 yards long and perforated by rows of tall, narrow window slits. They wondered how many 6x8 cells could fit into that building, and how many more similar buildings there were, and which building, which cell, was now inhabited by Skeet. Fully contained from the surrounding neighborhood, which looked not unlike East Orange, the grounds had their own order, with buildings fanning out from a central security hub. The men who lived there followed a specific schedule, designed in accordance with rehabilitation guidelines at the time. Trenton State felt like a warped college campus, and it seemed that a person could not achieve a greater sense of anonymity, of meaninglessness, than to become one of the 1,900 inmates. The visitors moved along, slowly, in a line to the point where Jackie stopped and let Rob see his father alone, as she would from now on, knowing that the long trip wouldn't be worthwhile to her son if his conversations with his father were monitored. She would sit in the waiting area and try not to think about the smell, which even here in the far fringe of the facility was a mixture of sweat, garbage, food of far lesser grade than what she worked with at the hospital, blood, feces, rot, guilt, resignation, a smell akin to the monotonous inevitability of death. On the long drives back to Newark, often as dusk and then night fell, she talked to Rob about the week of school coming up, what Victor was doing tomorrow, and what was going on with the girl Rob had a crush on. Everything but the man Rob had just seen. Rob would humor her, only rarely mentioning the various legal appeals that Skeet had slowly begun moving forward. Her son deeply, firmly believed that his father had been falsely accused by witnesses, set up by police, positioned to fail by the system, and wrongfully convicted by the jury. This Jackie knew and regretted because she saw nothing more hopeless that her son could waste his ample mind worrying about than his father's past or future. The past had happened. The future was literally locked in place. Neither could inform the present in any meaningful way. Her son, still such a boy, complete with a boy's terrible optimism, was not yet capable of understanding this kind of permanence as Jackie did. Like many other aspects of their reality, she figured that her son would be best served by learning about this on his own, in good time. But still, she dutifully took him to Trenton State, and these visits very much marked the passage of time during Rob's middle school years. The transit, the arduous entry process, the waiting room, the interstate rest, stop, fast food counters all added up to a singularly endless day for her, usually her only day off of the week. But to the boy, the actual time spent with Skeet must have seemed much too short. Each time Jackie parked on Chapman Street and entered the house afterward, she would feel relieved. No sooner could she experience that relief than Rob would ask when they could go back. Soon, she would tell him as she went to work making dinner, maybe in a couple of weeks. A few days would pass, and Rob would start talking about heading down to Trenton this coming Sunday after church. Sometimes she would be able to put the next visit off for 2 weeks, 3, but never more than 4. Rob was persistent in almost everything he did, and visiting his father more than the rest. For all the toll they took on her, the prison visits seemed to energize her son. Maybe this energy came from the way Skeet kept him up to date on his legal processes and enabled Rob to feel like an adult participant in contrast to the way he'd been largely removed from the actual trial. Or maybe he just liked to lay eyes on the man and be heartened by the fact that prison, during these first years, was not enough to break Skeet Douglas. If not surprised, exactly, Jackie was herself struck by how himself Skeet remained after his conviction. The trial had burdened and frustrated him to the point where communication had been hard. Skeet had simply come to exist on a lower wavelength than she. The verdict, while not the one of any of them desired, seemed to have released all that pressure and given him a return to his true form. When she did go in to see him now, maybe every third visit or so, he grinned and talked vibrantly about new friends inside while asking questions about old friends outside. He was clearly hopeful about his sentence eventually being overturned. She didn't know to whom he was talking. She was no longer privy to his legal undertakings, as Rob increasingly was. But Skeet took with him to Trenton State a hopefulness that was not contagious to Jackie, as it clearly was to their son. In the meantime, Rob seemed to expand through adolescence in every manner. His bones elongated and thickened. Muscles followed. Basic math and reading begat abstract problem-solving and reading comprehension skills. Boy-girl crushes became full-fledged, impassioned romantic pursuits, and his perspective of adults and adult behaviors, no doubt accelerated by his interactions with his father, matured to the point where he fully considered himself one, though he had not yet completed middle school. In the fall of 1993, Jackie lost her job due to mandatory cuts at University Hospital. She'd been stretching their finances thin lately, trying to spoil her son a little. She'd bought him a used bike so that he could ride to his friends' homes. She'd bought some new clothes to accommodate a recent growth spurt. She'd been trying to nourish him better with fresh produce instead of canned. Because of these efforts, she had no savings to carry her through a job search. After 2 weeks, her severance pay ran out, and unemployment insurance covered only the essentials. She had to take Rob out of Mount Carmel and send him back to Oakdale. "Okay," he said casually. "It's okay, Ma. We'll do what we need to do." He began leaving 100% of his work earnings on the counter for Jackie, which she found when returning home late each day after bussing around the city applying for jobs. Public school was much different in eighth grade than it had been in third grade, in terms not just of physical violence, but also emotional stress. From his first day back, Rob had to put more energy into navigating his fellow classmates in order to avoid being jumped or robbed, and this left little reserves with which to maintain his grades, to glean at least some new knowledge from the limited amount being dispensed in those classrooms, some of them packed with more than 40 kids at a time. Mount Carmel was not a high-end private school, but it was far enough removed from Oakdale to make for a surreal contrast. The disparity wasn't strictly financial, as Mount Carmel ran on a smaller operating budget per student than the publicly funded school and had no subsidies for books or supplies. The difference lay in the attitudes of both students and teachers. When Rob told Jackie casually that kids were dealing drugs, and a lot of them, at Oakdale, she knew two things immediately. She had to get him back into Mount Carmel and place him in a private high school next year. A part of her had been thinking that he could go to Orange High, just like Jackie had, and easily make it into their gifted student program. But in the wake of these Oakdale revelations, she took the bus to Orange High between job interviews in the middle of the school day. There, she stood on the sidewalk on South Orange Avenue and looked up the short rise to the building that she'd entered every day for 4 years in the mid-1960s. Aside from the food service supervisor program she'd attended after Skeet's arrest, this had been the last place she'd gone to school. Jackie was 44 years old. High school had been a quarter century ago. The place looked different now, and not simply because of the profane graffiti sprayed across its walls. It appeared to her that those hundreds of kids perched on the steps and leaning out of windows and milling around the yellowed lawn were training not for college or jobs, but for their destiny as loiterers, hustlers, and single mothers. Jackie felt very old in that moment. But the natural question, what had happened to 26 years, occurred to her only once, fleetingly, because its answer was obvious. Her son had happened. Many of her decisions had turned out poorly. Many of her circumstances were more precarious now than they'd ever been, and most of her dreams had fragmented. But her son remained, and he was bright, and he was strong, and he loved her to world's end. Jackie understood now, looking at her old high school, that she would never leave this place, Orange, like most of her siblings had. She was part of the asphalt fabric on which she stood. She also understood that with a few more years of determination and sacrifice on her part, Rob would leave. He would do so in spectacular fashion. She could almost visualize it, through the massive outlay of effort that sat between this stark moment and that prescient one. A few weeks later, Jackie found a job with a healthcare company that managed hundreds of nursing homes and post-hospital rehabilitation centers around the country. She was placed in the food service department at the Summit Ridge Center in West Orange. The job was a demotion from management back to kitchen work, but her employer pitched itself as a strong company in an expanding field with room to grow, and all these terms appealed to Jackie, who'd never had experience with a single one. She enjoyed riding the bus daily west toward the suburbs rather than east toward the city, to see her neighborhood open up and give way to fields and woods and ranch homes sprawling across half-acre plots along Route 501, to see where all those former neighbors she'd grown up with had moved during the 70s, while the Peace family had stayed put. The work starting out was worse than the hospital, and the kitchen had a hierarchy, of which she started on the bottom rung. That was jolting, having come from a place where co-workers generally tried to have fun and help each other by sharing car rides, covering shifts, being interested in the lives around them. She had a hard time falling in with the big corporation cost consciousness that led to her cooking food for the patients that she would never let her own family eat. But she was able to transfer Rob back to Mount Carmel. Christmas that year was very thin. Jackie could manage no more than some homemade baked goods and stocking stuffers. Rob didn't seem to mind. He told her that he considered the used bike, which she'd bought him last spring, to be like an early Christmas present, plus the encyclopedias. Jackie had gotten up to the G volume before losing her job. A few of her siblings came home for the holiday to sit in the living room with Horace and Francis. The house had been feeling too quiet lately, hollow in a way, and Jackie missed the chorus of arguments that used to resonate through the halls and stairways. She was worried that without anyone to engage him at home while she was working, Rob would reach farther and farther outward for stimulation, to people and locales where she had less control, if any at all. That year, at age 13, Rob learned how to drink alcohol and smoke marijuana. Absent was any ceremonious first time that would later be fondly remembered as a rite of passage. These two crutches were a standard aspect of the stoop culture on and around Chapman Street, and the matter was as simple as Rob, goaded by the older boys with whom he played football, climbing three steps onto a neighbor's porch, swigging from a bottle of beer, malt liquor, or E&J brandy, and then filling his lungs with a joint. And he liked it. The alcohol, since he had no tolerance for it, immediately brought forward a kind of blissful stupidity, a state in which words poured forth from his mouth free from analysis or reservation, and he must have found ease in laughing with others without weighing the relative meaning of what they had said. And then came the marijuana, with its immediate dilution of stress, and each of the five senses grew more receptive to minute pleasures in the air, in the sounds, in the faces. Under these influences, his father's trial and his mother's dreams must have seemed suddenly very far away, and far less a part of him than they actually were. This state of mind was easy to enter, particularly with the advent of spring and warm weather, when the whole neighborhood for a mile in every direction came out onto the stoops. Rob couldn't afford to buy alcohol or marijuana himself, but one of the benefits of remaining so well-known in East Orange, and being Skeet's boy, was that wherever he went, there were people, mostly men, who wanted to take care of him, and who didn't have much else to do. Rob would have to walk only a couple of blocks west, along Central Avenue in East Orange, past Harrison Street and Evergreen Place. He'd make a left on Burnett Street, and in three blocks he would be on Chestnut Street, near the building where his father had lived, where the Moore sisters had been murdered by someone Rob believed in his heart was not his father. And here he would be summoned onto stoop after stoop, asked how he was, asked how his father was doing, and ultimately asked if he wanted a sip or a toke. Victor Raymond accompanied him on a few of these excursions. At first, Victor was impressed by the extent to which his best friend was a part of the neighborhood, treated as an adult by all these other adults who seemed so cool and wise. He drank and smoked a little himself. Sometimes there were girls around, and he and Rob would take turns trying to talk to them, practicing lines. Always they heard music, about which Rob was increasingly passionate. He devoted much of his time to memorizing rap lyrics of groups like A Tribe Called Quest, breaking them down, analyzing them, internalizing the words as poetry. But Victor quickly and alarmingly noticed that for his friend, these walks were more than time-wasting little adventures, boys doing things they shouldn't be doing and hoping not to get in trouble later. And these people who Rob kept introducing him to with pride, dozens of people, were not so cool, not so wise. These were grown men and women who sat on their front porches all day, in various states of inebriation, listening to music. Rob threw himself into these gatherings with an intensity not evident in anyone else, which Victor struggled to confront directly. Rob knew who was having car trouble, who was looking for a job, who was behind on rent. He knew everything about everyone, it seemed to Victor, and was able to store each separate personal story in that cavernous brain of his. Like a math or science problem, Rob was always trying to get inside these people, figure them out, learn their problems, provide solutions. Most disturbing to Victor was the almost professional means by which Rob hid these vices from his mother and grandparents. Saline drops for the eyes, spearmint gum for the breath, aerosol deodorant for the clothes, and preternatural ability to carry himself with as much controlled composure, high, as he did sober. Victor much preferred the Caribbean Festival in Prospect Park, Brooklyn, to which he and Rob took the train together every year to walk with the brightly dressed crowds down wide, blockaded avenues, far from those they lived on, drinking mango juice and eating jerk chicken off skewers, and meeting smiley strangers with melodic island accents. That was his favorite day of the year, and that was the Rob piece he liked best. The private high schools were all well known. Seton Hall Prep, the Immaculate Heart of Mary, Essex Catholic, and St. Benedict's Prep. Simply put, these schools sent students to college, and more important, in most cases, they were affordable. Each accepted 100 to 200 freshmen a year, roughly 600 placements for the 10,000 or so teenagers of Greater Newark seeking the opportunity. Each had tours, interviews, and entrance exams. About half the students at Mount Carmel applied, guided through the process by the nuns. Some of these children had never written a personal essay before and were stymied by questions like, in 200 words or less, describe yourself. Victor was already committed to attending St. Benedict's, the only all-boys school. He had geared much of his last 2 years around applying, writing letters to the faculty there, going to soccer and baseball games, attending community open houses. Rob and Jackie toured each of the schools, and she could tell immediately that he gravitated toward St. Benedict's too, her last choice, due mainly to geography. Seton Hall and Immaculate had relatively expansive campuses in suburban West Orange and Wayne, respectively, whereas St. Benedict's was a compact building in central Newark on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, in the exact opposite direction of her new job. Traffic would be terrible during both rush hours, and the neighborhood immediately surrounding the school was sketchy at best, with adjacent basketball courts and fast food restaurants tailor-made for hustlers. The school was 2 blocks from the courthouse in which Rob's father had been convicted of murder. But she empowered her son to choose, and she figured he based his decision on staying close with Victor and on the matter of diversity. St. Benedict's was the least diverse of the 4 schools. The student body was 89% black and Hispanic. The school had a much more generous financial aid program than the others due to its strong and successful alumni network. The tuition was $8,700 per year against an overhead cost of $16,000 per student, along with further financial aid available based on need. Rob was waitlisted at first. No one understood why, but figured it had to do with the financial statements, which Rob had undertaken himself. Maybe he'd left them incomplete. Maybe he'd fudged a little. Victor, who'd been accepted with a B average at Mount Carmel, told his aunt. The next day she went to the school, personally, sat down in the headmaster's office, and said she would raise a stunning amount of hell if they didn't accept Robert Peace. Jackie received the acceptance letter the following week, which left her anxiously waiting to learn what aid they would offer. The envelope came in the late spring, after a long day of work, during which she'd been yelled at constantly by her boss, an irritable white man who supervised the kitchen at Summit Ridge. St. Benedict's offered Rob a tuition of $4,000 per year, a $500 down payment, followed by monthly installments of $388 if she opted to pay only during the 9-month school year, or $291 if she wanted to pay continuously year-round. The decision was a hard one and involved a lot of math that Rob helped her sort through. She'd been paying $200 for Mount Carmel, but with her recent pay cut, that tuition was already gouging the food budget. The extra $90 per month, and additional 3 months of payments, would begin encroaching on utilities and other basic costs. She'd have to ask her parents to pay the full property taxes this year, and probably for the next 4 if she wasn't promoted. "You'll get promoted soon," Rob told her. "I know you will, and I can get a real job." She kept looking at the numbers he'd written in his lined composition book, where he kept track of his own wages. "Ma," he said with conviction beyond his years, "we'll do this. It's important. It'll be all good. You can bring home food from work. I'll eat whatever." "Yeah," she said. "You'd eat horse meat if it was put in front of you with ketchup. And that's just about what I'm serving these days." She took his arm, about to give him a hastily prepared speech about focusing on work and taking advantage of this coming opportunity. But she said nothing. Rob didn't need to hear it. He already knew. Part 2. Prep. Chapter 4. For Rob, the summer of 1994 lasted all of 3 weeks. 3 weeks of sweltering heat, and football games, and stoop-hopping around East Orange, sometimes drunk and often high. Then, during the second week of July, the incoming freshman class of St. Benedict's showed up for summer phase, which in their collective minds was akin to summer camp, but would prove to be something different entirely. 140 14-year-old boys passed through the small vestibule on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, bookended by automated, double-locked doors that were controlled by the guard in the adjacent Glaston security station. They filed beneath the sign in the lobby that read in bold gray letters, "Whatever hurts my brother hurts me," and down a hallway of classrooms to the gymnasium known as the Hive, in reference to the school mascot, the Gray Bee. Here, they lined up in rows with sleeping bags and duffels at their feet. This group came from 40 different towns and 60 middle schools in and around Newark. The boys represented all economic backgrounds, but were weighted toward lower and lower middle class. They stood there and took each other in, some loose and cracking jokes among already formed small groups, others stiff and nervous and alone. Even before Friar Edwin Leahy, their new headmaster, made his lofty speech about the trust and unity they would have to build in order to succeed here and in life, the incoming students intuited that the next 4 years were crucial, that there would be no do-overs or second chances. They had all gone through the rigorous application process. They had chosen this school, knowing all the challenges ahead of them. They were committed to becoming men here. Summer phase officially began with the singing of the school song. After that weak and discordant effort, the group was divided into 18 colors, with 8 boys randomly assigned to each group. These colors would account for a large part of each student's identity over the next 4 years. Rob was tagged maroon, which at the very least trumped the pink to which he'd never grown accustomed. Summer phase entailed full academic days, followed by sports games and evening group activities, and then the gym lights clanked off over the boys as they whispered in their sleeping bags on the floor. The gym had been built in the 1940s and never renovated. The hardboard basketball court was bowed and splintered, and mice could be heard in the walls. The boys did everything in their color groups, classes, meals, even toothbrushing. In between structured activities, they were required to learn the first and last name of every other student in the class before week's end, as well as memorize the lyrics to 5 school songs, which were to be sung in the hallways between classes for the duration of freshman year. They had to leave all their belongings in the gym, fully exposed. No locks were permitted inside the school. At the end of the week, they took a test in which they wrote the name of each classmate, as well as the names and dates of every headmaster in the 126-year history of St. Benedict's. Only then did the students formally receive gym t-shirts and shorts in the colors they had been assigned. The purpose of these various structures was obvious to the freshmen. Memorizing names and songs fostered discipline and loyalty. The color assignments kept the boys from forming their own cliques. The schoolwork gave them a preview of what to expect come fall semester. The unsecured belongings built trust. The overnights implanted a feeling of shared experience, of family. And yet a greater aim loomed behind all this effort that would be apparent to the boys only years later, after they'd left St. Benedict's and begun navigating the challenges of adulthood. Trouble and staying out of it. Friar Edwin Leahy and the elderly Benedictine monks who ran this school knew that before they could teach math and history, before they could coach soccer and baseball, before they could take attendance or host parent nights, they had to preempt the problems to which this group of boys, most of them urban, many living with minimal family guidance, was prone. Through decades of experience, the faculty had learned the many forms these problems took. Fights, theft, and negative attitudes were the most common. Beyond those lay the more disruptive tendencies of emotional abuse inflicted on peers, dealing and using drugs, or dropping out of school entirely. The preventative measure the school deployed against these lurking obstacles was a combination of keeping the boys very, very busy, while fortifying them with school pride, an inoculation, so to speak, administered primarily through force of repetition and a borderline invasive control over the most precious asset in their lives, their time. Rob went through the summer phase largely unnoticed by anyone, including Victor, who had been assigned to a different color group. He stood out only once, near the end of the week when summer reading assignments were given. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, A Light in August by William Faulkner, and Chesapeake by James Michener. While the other boys emitted disbelieving laughter at the sheer weight and thickness of the combined pages, Rob sat cross-legged on his bundle of blankets, opened the cover of Chesapeake, 888 pages, and spent the hour before lights out quietly reading. He'd already read the two other books on his own for fun. A rumor had also been circulating that there was a boy in the class who knew the lyrics of every Bone Thugs and Harmony song, every single word to every single song. Because these songs were typically so fast-paced, they sounded like a random spewage of consonants and vowels. Learning one song, let alone all of them, was a feat that inspired awe in the freshman class. They began asking around, "Who's the Bone Thugs kid?" He was Rob Peace. St. Benedict's Preparatory School for Boys was founded in 1868 by a group of Benedictine monks, and over the next 99 years, it expanded from a church and small schoolhouse to a group of structures spread over a full city block. During the post-war boom in Newark, the student body came to be composed primarily of the white sons of affluent white men in the area, the leaders of the city's corporate and manufacturing sectors. Headmaster Edwin Leahy graduated in 1964 and left for Divinity School, planning to return to St. Benedict's afterward and teach English. Then the 1967 riots happened, the thickest of the violence in the 2nd Police Precinct, right outside the school's red brick walls. While the live-in monks fortified themselves within, the city center was decimated, not just in terms of property, but also in attitudes and in trust. The racial tension left in the aftermath of the riots was compounded by the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., who later gave name to the very street St. Benedict's was built on, in April 1968, followed by Robert Kennedy's in June, and the expansion of American involvement in Vietnam, which manifested itself in a draft that summoned by force of law many hundreds of young, uneducated black men from their homes in and around Newark. A racial awakening occurred in these homes, in the town halls and in the streets of downtown. The St. Benedict's faculty, most of them elderly, pacifist white men who wore dark red robes and grew thick white beards beneath their spectacles, was not equipped to adjust to the tension, nor were the school's traditional students prepared to commute from their suburban homes into the city center, the crucible of unrest. More than a dozen teachers left for cushier positions at wealthier monasteries. In 1972, the school found itself unable to reach a sustainable attendance. The doors closed with no promise of reopening, even as a church. This was the state of the school when Friar Leahy came back. He was 24 years old, skinny and pale and relatively green. He was also fearless, ambitious, and direct. He saw that the school closure had more to do with the energy, or lack thereof, of the monks than with any new social reality that had taken hold of the city. So he recruited a group of young, fresh, liberal divinity school graduates, and he led the movement to reopen the school in 1973, not as St. Benedict's Prep, but as a smaller, religion-focused educational venture. This effort actually exacerbated rather than alleviated the anger within the African-American community. At a town hall meeting that spring, Friar Leahy fielded a question from a young black mother in the crowd. She said, "How come you call the school St. Benedict's Prep when it's all of you around, but now that it's all of us around, you don't call it prep anymore?" Her remark seemed to exemplify all the social issues in the country that seemed impossibly complicated. In 1974, Friar Leahy reopened the St. Benedict's Preparatory School for Boys with a new mission to serve young men from the urban districts within and immediately surrounding the city. The transition didn't occur overnight, nor did it always occur smoothly. And yet, quicker than any of the monks expected, and in the middle of one of the most tumultuous decades in New York's history, something happened that many residents in the city, both white and black, had previously dismissed as a progressive fantasy. The African-American community of Newark took ownership of the school. Nurturing this change was not easy. From a business standpoint, with tuition covering just half of the per-student overhead, nobody could make sense of the budget, and Friar Leahy spent two-thirds of his time on the phone or in meetings, beggar's hat in hand, tasked with raising $1 million a year just to cover operating costs. But the school grew, thanks to an alumni network predating the school's reinvention that remained extremely loyal and extremely wealthy, even though the student body was suddenly unrecognizable to them. By the time Rob and Victor arrived in 1994, Friar Leahy was raising $5 million per year from a reliable network of corporate and individual donors. The school had a pool, an auditorium, a sports complex with a turf field and synthetic track, a science wing with sufficient chemistry and physics equipment for each student to run his own individual experiments, a computer room with a row of Apple IIcs, and a library with 6,000 books. But even though the school had modernized and flourished, the biggest challenge these teachers faced each fall was still the same challenge that had existed in 1973. Two decades before Rob ever walked onto the grounds. How to minister to the often crippling emotional trauma caused by the suboptimal home lives of so many students, and in doing so, free their cognition and their potential in full. Rob's friends from the neighborhood, the ones he played ball, drank, and smoked with, cracked themselves up in the weeks leading up to the fall term. His school had fencing, water polo, and chess teams, but no football. They wondered loudly how a badass like Rob Peace could have chosen an all-boys prep school like that over a real school like Orange High. They made Jesus jokes. They made pussy jokes. They made gay jokes. Rob had no grounds to fight them over it, because in his eyes, these friends were more or less right to laugh. Matriculation at St. Benedict's posed problems. Through a special application process with the Orange Township School Board, Rob and Victor acquired waivers to play on Orange High's football team in the fall while attending St. Benedict's during the day. They went to two-a-days in the August heat. The players spent the first practice on hands and knees in full pads picking glass from broken bottles out of the field. Rob played running back and linebacker in the JV squad's first scrimmage the week before the school year started. Some of his upperclassmen teammates had been playing with him in the street games for 5 years. So he didn't have to prove himself the way many freshmen did. Other teammates knew him as a guy who liked to chill and get stoned around East Orange, and they were amazed at his intensity, his desire for collision. For the first 3 weeks of school, he would catch the bus downtown at 6, get to school by 7, go through the school day, catch another bus to Orange High at 3, be on the field by 4, practice until 6, catch another bus home, and read until he fell asleep. The schedule left him with little energy to socialize at school, where most of the boys were still in the process of checking one another out, projecting confidence, while feeling insecure in their new surroundings. Between classes, freshmen were required to walk with their right shoulders touching the wall at all times, while singing the school songs in a predetermined order. The upperclassmen maintained discipline in this regard, and they were quick to call out any freshman they saw breaking rank with a smack on the back of the head. The students stayed with their colors throughout the day, from convocation in the morning to classes to meals to gym. Each of the 18 colors had its own president and vice president in the senior class, tasked with addressing any behavioral or academic problems that arose within the group. Entering the school, the freshmen could roll their eyes at this manufactured brotherhood and its hierarchy reminiscent of British imperialism. But day by day, the system had a way of drawing them in. An individual young man could easily get lost among 500 other young men in the school. Among 25 wearing his same color and obligated to look out for him, he couldn't. Rob did get lost, and not by accident. Because of football, he was able to feel like he could come to St. Benedict's each morning and take advantage of its curriculum and facilities without buying into its philosophies. He showed up on time, sang the songs, and went through the motions without ever fully engaging with them, as if he were in on the joke that his friends from the neighborhood were in on. And the moment classes ended each day, he was out the door, on the bus, then on the field, in pads, standing among the boys he lived with, bashing his head against theirs. Immediately, the smartest kids at St. Benedict's stood out. The school encouraged this by posting grades in the hallways. The majority of this subset commuted from the suburbs, where they had attended private middle schools, and their families were intact. Their good grades were, in the oversimplified view of less fortunate peers, a given. For the students of lesser means, part of the sacrifice of coming to a school like St. Benedict's was the knowledge that they would never be among the smartest in the class. Which was why, when cumulative GPAs first went up halfway through the fall of freshman year, and Robert Peace was listed among with three other names at the top with 4.0s, guys were confused. Nobody knew much about Rob yet, just that he did the football thing and lived west of downtown and strutted around with a dour expression on his face, while referring to himself as Sean. Once his grades were made public, a collective perception formed of a wealthy, well-educated black kid from the suburbs who walked around acting like he was from the hood. The year might have continued like that, with St. Benedict's being a school Rob attended rather than an ideal he was a part of, if not for the clumsy bureaucracy of the Orange School Board. A month into the football season, an administrator filing insurance forms noticed that two names on the football roster weren't registered in the Orange system. The next day, as they hustled out onto the field for practice, Rob and Victor learned that they could no longer play football due to the insurance liability. Rob took it hard, but Jackie had no patience for her son suddenly moping around. She'd disapproved of the football situation anyway. Her son bussing all over town among the transients, not taking full advantage of his own school campus, that she was stretching herself thinner than ever just to pay for, all so that he could participate in legalized violence alongside boys she wished he didn't know anyway. "What am I going to do now?" he mumbled. "St. B's has sports teams," she replied. "Lots of them. Find one and join it." He laughed. "Like what, fencing?" "Well, you wear a helmet, just like in football." "Mom, please." "You want to play football?" Jackie said, feeling an energy surge that was rare for her these days. "Because I'm sure as hell fine to take you out of that school and send you to Orange High. You can play as much football as you want there." He thought about her words and looked away, momentarily silent. And Jackie smiled, as with his father, she rarely got the last word in with her son. Wayne Ridley had graduated from St. Benedict's in 1990, and he'd started teaching and coaching there the year before Rob arrived. He'd grown up in Irvington, just west of downtown Newark, in that gray area between the heavily policed city blocks and the outlying wilderness where the neighborhoods truly began to fray. He coached the swim team, and in the late fall of 1994, a powerfully built but still soft freshman approached him about joining. "Sure," Coach Ridley said. "You in shape?" "Yeah." "Come out this afternoon and swim some laps." Rob didn't reply. His limbs were a little short for a swimmer. He had muscle there, but no litheness, no grace. "You have something else you need to do? Because you came to me here."
"No,"
Rob said. "It's just that I don't swim."
"You don't swim?"
"I mean, I don't know how to swim." During practice that day, while the team swam their daily 240 laps, 6,000 yards, or a little less than 4 miles, Rob lowered himself into the half lane adjacent to the wall. Coach Ridley began guiding him through the physical dynamics of freestyle, breaststroke, backstroke, and butterfly. He understood the toll this took on the boy's pride, splashing slowly and clumsily while the pool teemed with 2 dozen boys his age, cruising swiftly through the water. And Rob came off as a particularly prideful kid. Ridley didn't expect him to last more than a few days, especially when Rob ditched the second practice, claiming that he had sprained his back as a result of sneezing while simultaneously grabbing milk out of his refrigerator at home. But he came back, and by the end of the winter swim team season, he could handle himself capably enough in the water to come out for the polo team the following fall. Swimming and water polo were cool sports at St. Benedict's, and Tavares Hester was the prized recruit of the freshman class. Tavares was short and scrawny, but a natural and experienced swimmer. He had grown up in East Orange with a single parent. His was a rare case in which the mother had abandoned the family. She would disappear for stretches of 6 months or a year throughout his childhood, and she fled for good when Tavares was 12. He and his older brother had been raised by their father, a good man, a good parent, Tavares's best friend. In the spring of 8th grade, Tavares's father died suddenly of cancer. He'd gone to the doctor with a persistent stomachache one afternoon, and 3 months later was buried. Tavares's admission to St. Benedict's with significant financial aid had been the last positive thing that had happened before his father died. Tavares now lived with his aunt and grandmother, provided for by Social Security checks, and he'd entered St. Benedict's in a conscious state of not giving a fuck about anything except drinking, smoking, and swimming. Tavares had been assigned to Rob's color group, so he knew him a little better than the rest of their classmates. During the fall of freshman year, he'd sensed an anger in Rob that ran parallel to his own. So, when football was taken away, he told Rob to come swim. He tried to explain how there was something cathartic about being in the water. You stared down at the thick black line scrolling steadily beneath you, and all you heard was the rush of water past your ears, and a life that at times felt cosmically complicated was reduced to the simplest elements: oxygen, buoyancy, propulsion. Rob listened, and because he did, through swim team practice, that winter and water polo the following autumn, he met the 4 friends who would compose the daily heart and rhythm of his life until its end. Drew Jemison grew up in Montclair, a middle-class suburb northeast of the Oranges. His father had left when he was 4, but his mother's boyfriend, Snow, had been a steadfast presence since then. Not a father, exactly, but the next best thing. Drew was massive, with a booming voice that belied his relatively soft sensibilities. He wasn't a brawler because he didn't have to be. Just by standing up straight, he projected an assurance of never being confronted about anything. He played goalie, his wide shoulders and long arms all but blocking the whole net. Julius Flowey Starks was tall and almost cartoonishly thin, with a long face that gave him an ever-present hangdog expression. He and his twin sister Tess had grown up in the worst of poverty, the father killed by violence, and their mother troubled enough to practically destroy their formative years, yet functional enough that social services had never intervened in their home on 18th Avenue off the Garden State Parkway. They lived in the very center of Greater Newark's web of drugs and violence, a place where lethality hovered close by always. People called him Flowey for his ability to exist casually in a grid of blocks where men and boys could be killed simply for walking down a street they didn't live on. He was all good with everyone, he just flowed. The last words he remembered hearing from his father without much momentousness were, "You ain't gonna live to see 21." But his uncle was the dean of discipline at St. Benedict's, and Flowey had chosen to apply to and pay for St. Benedict's fully on his own, using Social Security checks for supplies. He'd undertaken this mainly because he'd known that going to public school with girls would sentence him to fatherhood by age 16, and he wanted to evade that pattern, one from which he himself had been born. At 6'5", and 150 pounds, soaking wet, he was awkward in the hallways, barely able to wedge himself behind the classroom desks. But in the pool, he was in control, and with a sharp scissor kick could elevate his body from the water up to the waist and extend his long arms still higher for towering, indefensible shot angles. Curtis Gamble was an amiable leader in the school immediately. He was curious, easygoing, hilarious. The boy who knew how to best spend each hour. His mother was white, his father was black, and they were both school teachers. Their home on Smith Street in East Orange was about a mile southeast of Rob's, and would provide a refuge and a family for the rest of the newly formed crew, particularly Tavaris, Flowey, and Rob, none of whom had ever known truly what those two words meant. Curtis, with his relatively comfortable circumstances and laid-back approach to life, served as a model, the person they all wanted